It is Wednesday, December 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. In the next half hour, we'll hear from rights group Amnesty International, which says Russia may have committed war crimes in Syria by killing civilians with airstrikes. We'll look at how close the Iraqi military is to retaking control of the city of Ramadi from Islamic State militants. And we'll tell you which two countries have approved the use of the world's first dengue vaccine. It's all ahead on International Edition. A report released Wednesday by rights group Amnesty International says Russia's air campaign in Syria has killed hundreds of civilians and caused massive destruction in residential areas. The rights group claims that the pattern of Russian attacks shows evidence of violations of international law. Well, earlier I spoke to Anya Neistat, Senior Director for Research at Amnesty, and I asked her how her organization gathered evidence of civilian casualties from the Russian airstrikes.
Well, there were several methodologies that we used. We interviewed witnesses to the attacks. We had to interview them remotely as we couldn't get access to the site, but we interviewed them over phone and internet. We also spoke to activists on the ground who collect this information on a regular basis, as well as doctors. In addition, we reviewed video and audio materials that were collected in the aftermath of the attacks, and then we commissioned military experts to analyze them to determine the nature of destruction and what type of weapons, bombs, and missiles have been used. But probably most importantly, in trying to identify whether the airstrikes were actually Russian, we also compared the strikes that we documented to the statements made by the Russian authorities. So we went through Russian media reports and official statements from the Ministry of Defense where they claim that they have hit a particular target. And by making this comparison, we're able to make the determination.
Well, Russia says that it is targeting terrorists. So why do you think it would carry out strikes on civilian areas where there aren't any militants, as your report suggested?
Well, why is a difficult to ask, but what we did document is that in the attacks that we included in our report, we see that either these residential areas were directly hit because there seemed to be absolutely no military targets in the vicinity, and that's five out of six attacks that we documented in detail, and in one case, the attack appears to be disproportionate. Even though there might have been a military target in the vicinity, the civilian damage way was the damage made to the military object. So in most cases, we believe that Russia is not using sufficient care in strikes. But also, we have to remember that Russia has been a long-time supporter of Assad's regime, and Assad's regime and Syrian forces have been killing civilians in thousands on a regular basis over the last 3 years. So I think it's very much in line of what Russia has been seen doing for the 3 years. Just now they're more directly involved.
Okay, well, thank you very much to Anya Neistat of Amnesty International for speaking to International Edition.
Thank you.
Well, it's time for a check of social media, and Olin Akosholu joins me in the studio for a look at what people have been tweeting about this Amnesty report on Russian airstrikes in Syria. Hey, Olin.
Hi, Michael. Amnesty International has been very active in trying to get this report shared on social media already, and it's been tweeting out different facts from the report using Twitter handles like @AmnestyPress and @AmnestyOnline. And Anya Neistat, who you just spoke to, she's, of course, the Senior Director for Research at Amnesty International. She tweeted a link to an interactive map showing the location of Russian airstrikes in Syria and some reports on casualties and the damage caused in each strike. For people that are interested in reading the full report, they can actually go online and read the whole document. It's being hosted on Amnesty International's website, and different Amnesty International Twitter handles have been tweeting out links to make it easy to find.
Well, how have social media users been reacting to this report?
Well, oftentimes the Russian Foreign Ministry tweets a response when Russia becomes the focus of international news like this, but that hasn't been the case with this latest Amnesty International report. So far, people have been tweeting the different facts shared by Amnesty International, retweeting rather, but looking at how people are responding to the report on Twitter, Amnesty International Online, they tweeted out a link to the report from the handle at Amnesty Online, and people who responded to the tweet were mostly people saying that the report singles out Russia and saying Turkey is also responsible for human rights abuses in Syria, specifically against Kurdish fighters. But the report is still hitting social media. Many people who are likely to react in the U.S. are still asleep, so the response may change as it starts to get more attention from Twitter users.
Okay, we'll keep track of that. Thank you very much, Olin.
You bet, Michael.
This is VOA.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views, presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
I'm Michael Lippin with VOA's International Edition. Iraqi security forces backed by U.S.-led airstrikes and Sunni tribesmen have advanced on the center of the provincial capital of Ramadi. The Iraqi advance is part of a weeks-long offensive to retake control of Ramadi from Islamic State fighters who captured the city in May. James Jeffrey is a former U.S. ambassador to Baghdad and now a fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He told VOA's Victor Beatty that while Islamic State fighters are relatively small in number, they have had months to dig into Ramadi and could be difficult to dislodge.
We've seen this on many fronts. You need overwhelming forces, American airstrikes, and an awful lot of time. And of course, what we've talked about before is I'm not so sure time is on our side.
Meaning what, sir?
A, ISIS's ability to launch terrorist attacks. B, ISIS's control of much of Iraq and Syria. C, the impact of that on the Syrian civil war. D, the possibility, if we're not careful, that this will slip out of control into a Sunni-Shia war. And E, the fact that ISIS's continued presence is giving Putin the excuse to intervene massively all over the region, doing almost everything to expand his power and reduce ours while doing very little against his ostensible goal, degrading ISIS.
Does that lend more credence to the significance of a victory in Ramadi?
Victory in Ramadi is a good thing. We need more of them. I think that in other cities, particularly in Mosul, in Raqqa, and parts of eastern Syria, we'll find that these people fight even harder with more forces. One thing of note is, while Shia militias were not involved, a fair number of Sunni Arabs have been involved in the fighting in Ramadi and elsewhere in Anbar. There we have the largest concentration of Sunni Arabs who are fighting with the Iraqi government and with us against ISIS. That may not be the case in other areas.
Are U.S. forces at all involved, directly or indirectly?
Well, they're involved, first of all, in the airstrikes, secondly, in planning and coordinating missions. They're not as involved as I would like them to be. They're not as involved as Secretary Carter wants them to be because the Iraqis did not, as far as I can see, accept his idea to use Apache helicopters and perhaps to move troops closer to the front.
Is that because Baghdad is somewhat beholden to Iran and wants to keep on good relations with Tehran?
To some degree, but another degree is Baghdad knew that it was probably going to win this thing and felt that it would not have as much criticism from Iran and from the Shia militias and Shia members of parliament if it could do it on its own rather than a lot of very ostentatious help by the United States. The problem is Ramadi is one battle of many, and in other areas there's going to be more need for us to be more active.
Well, that was James Jeffrey, a fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, speaking to International Edition's Victor Beatty. The Philippines has granted approval for a new dengue vaccine, joining Mexico as the only countries to allow usage of the treatment. As VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok, the vaccine could stop the spread of the potentially deadly virus, which is transmitted by mosquitoes.
Dengvaxia comes at a time when a safe and effective vaccine is urgently needed, according to the World Health Organization. Dr. Joselito Santa Anna, head of dengue vaccine operations in the region for Sanofi Pasteur, says the vaccine has been demonstrated effective against all four dengue virus types.
The vaccine actually is given in three-dose schedule with a 6-month interval. It is being given from 9 years of age up to 45 years of age. This is the age range wherein most of the dengue cases are being reported, particularly in endemic countries here in Asia.
The vaccine's maker is hailing it as an important tool to reach the World Health Organization's objective on dengue, for which children are at particular risk.
Together with vector control, it will form an integrated approach in reducing dengue mortality by 50% and reducing the dengue morbidity by more than 25% by 2020.
Clinical tests were carried out on 40,000 people from 15 countries. Some two-thirds of those over the age of 9 were deemed to be protected, and the vaccine was found to be 93% effective against the most severe form of the disease, dengue hemorrhagic fever. While being hailed as a breakthrough, there is concern about whether it will provide significant protection in the long term. Another question mark is cost. Newly developed pharmaceutical products are frequently very expensive when they initially go on sale and not affordable for many patients. But Dr. Santa Anna says the vaccine's maker wants to maximize the access to all populations, while acknowledging the market price of Dengvaxia has not yet been established.
We are committed to offering a fair and equitable price for the vaccine that is sustainable both for the company and the government who is going to implement it in the public program.
The vaccine, in development for 25 years, has been submitted for licensing in 18 other countries in Asia and Latin America where dengue is endemic. Pharmaceutical companies in Japan, Britain, and the United States are also developing dengue vaccines. Dengue was traditionally a disease primarily confined to the tropics. Now about half of the world's population is considered at risk due to urbanization, jet travel, and climate change. Dengue cases have soared 30-fold in the last half century, according to the WHO, with an estimated 400 million people now infected annually. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A new study that examined more than half of Earth's freshwater supply finds climate change is quickly warming the world's lakes, which is seen as a threat to the supply of fresh water and its ecosystems. Researchers analyzed more than 25 years of data that included temperature and ground measurements of some 235 lakes located throughout six continents. They found that our planet's lakes are warming by 0.34 degrees Celsius every 10 years. And while the noted temperature increase may seem small and insignificant, the scientists say it's bigger than the warming rate of either the ocean or the atmosphere. They say water temperature can affect the health and sustainability of our ecosystems. They add that when there's such a quick and wide shift away from normal lake temperatures, the life forms it supports could change radically and even disappear. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. Here in the U.S., a museum known as the National Christmas Center is the only one of its kind in the world to be packed with vintage toys and ornaments. The privately owned center in the small town of Paradise, Pennsylvania, is drawing many international visitors. VOA's Deborah Block takes us to one of the most Christmassy places in America.
The National Christmas Center is full of nostalgia and thousands of items reflecting the holiday spirit. This room features charming toys from different eras. Lindsay Hallman came to visit with her children.
I love seeing the different toys, and it definitely brings me back to when I was a kid, the excitement about Christmas.
The old stuff is new to her son, Brody, who is just as excited.
There's lots of lights and a lot of Christmas trees are up.
500 Santa Claus figures are scattered throughout the museum, including this North Pole workshop and an exhibit on Christmas around the world. These figurines go back to the 1800s. Museum curator Jim Morrison says Santa's clothing has changed over time.
100 years ago, he had blue pants and a red top and white fur, and that kind of developed into the Red Santa that we know today.
About 3/4 of the objects in the center come from Morrison, who began collecting all things Christmas as a child.
Here is a little train that my aunt gave me when I was 3 years old. That little train started all of this here.
Now in his 70s, Morrison put his treasures into this building to share his love of Christmas with others.
Christmas was changing in America. I kind of liked the way it was when I was a little boy, so we built this through the imagination of a child. All the special things, caroling, the Christmas tree, just memories of generations.
Visitor Walter Smith wishes today's Christmas could be more like the old days.
Today it's gotten so commercial. Years ago, Christmas meant something, and it was the simple things in life back then.
He and other visitors are especially taken by the recreated Woolworth store, the first retail chain to sell factory-made goods at cheap prices. For more than a century, starting in the late 1800s, Woolworth was the place to go for Christmas decorations and toys. For older visitors, the center's memorabilia takes them back to being a kid again. And for kids, it's a look at the joy of Christmas before they were born. Deborah Block, VOA News, Paradise, Pennsylvania.
The U.S. music magazine Billboard's year-end lists of the biggest hits of 2015 are out, giving critics and fans a chance to agree or disagree. International Edition's David Byrd sat down with the lady DJ, Shauna Renee, to talk about which artists and songs topped Billboard's R&B and hip-hop lists for the past year.
You used to call me on my cell phone, late night when you need my love. Call me on my cell phone, late night when you need my love.
Drake dominated this year. Not only did he dominate this list, which is Billboard's list of top R&B and hip-hop artists, but he's been dominating lists, Spotify lists, MTV lists, you name it. He's at the top of the list because 2015 was such an incredible year for him. He released, if you're reading this, It's Too Late, which was his album. This year, he also released a mixtape with Future. He went on tour. He's just kind of been all over the place. He has this incredible video out now that everyone loves and is talking about. So he came out on top of this Billboard list of artists.
Now, The Weeknd, if you've been listening to pop music at all, right, you've heard I Can't Feel My Face. But he had 12 currently charting songs at the same time?
Yeah. Weeknd has not only dominated the R&B charts, but he dominated the Hot 100 artist charts, digital song charts, streaming charts, and then also on the R&B side, they're like these adult R&B charts, and these are kind of songs that appeal to an older audience, and he's dominating those charts as well. I mean, though this was the year of Drake, Weeknd was not far behind.
Now, we talked about some of the other folks on this list. Let's start with Fetty Wap.
So Fetty Wap is this hip-hop artist. He's kind of like what we call a trap artist. And so his song, Trap Queen, has become sort of like an anthem. And, I mean, MTV embraced him, and then all of a sudden, everyone else started to as well. And some people might consider his music an acquired taste. It certainly took me a little while to get into it. But once I did, I realized that he is actually something special. He really is, I think, unique in that he's very authentic. He talks about his experiences. And if you kind of keep it in the context of which it is being created, you understand
don't
that.
Do it for me. Now watch me whip. Kill it. Now watch me nae-nae. Okay. Now watch me whip. Watch me nae-nae. Why me do it?
There's a couple of acts that got their fame primarily through YouTube. and through going viral. Let's start off with Silento with Watch Me.
Right.
And then you have I Love Memphis with Rock the Kwan.
These are dances. So his song Watch Me is a series of dances that he put together. And Rock the Kwan is a dance. So that's what makes these so special. And so he's in the gym and he's doing, like, I think he said it was maybe a minute. And then he started noticing everyone was uploading videos, doing these dances. And he said, well, let's expand this. He expands it. He puts it on YouTube. It goes viral. He gets signed. And now he's looking to 2016 to maybe be a breakout year for him.
All right. Well, what do you think? Do you have a top 10 list of acts that you followed in 2015? Send a tweet to Shauna. She's at VOA Lady DJ. And you can always log on to our website. That's voanews.com.
Well, you've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. Your director today was Patrice Martin, and the engineer was Al Santos. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. If you want to find me on Twitter, I am at Michael_Lippin. You can also find International Edition there, too. We are at VOA_IE. That's it for now. We'll see you next time.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The corrosive nature of corruption is well known. As U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has stated, corruption fuels instability and robs innocent people of their due and their possibilities. Secretary Kerry also said that as deeply rooted as corruption can be in some countries, it is not inevitable. One country that has made strides in fighting corruption is Ukraine. At a panel discussion at the U.S. Institute of Peace in Washington, William Brownfield, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for the Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs, noted that Ukraine's Maidan Revolution, which started in 2013, was largely a public response to rampant corruption. Taking to the streets, the Ukrainian people, at the cost of 100 lives, stood up and said, "We want change." Assistant Secretary Brownfield observed that some anti-corruption measures, since Ukraine's current government was elected in 2014, have been significant. For example, the government has implemented a system in which property must be registered online and government contracts must be procured online, making arrangements previously made behind closed doors public. Additionally, the government has established new rules relating to campaign finance and media ownership. Assistant Secretary Brownfield said, however, the solution to corruption is not just technical, it is also in the institutions themselves. He noted that the State Department's Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs, or INL, has spent $25 million on assisting Ukraine to build transparent, effective institutions. Those efforts include helping train and equip the Ukrainian Border Guard services. The Ukrainian Border Guard Service and a new National Patrol Police Force, aiding an NGO-run vetting center that will vet all police and personnel throughout the government, and supporting a new Inspector General in the Prosecutor General's office. In addition, INL is providing grants to several civil society organizations to monitor Ukraine's anti-corruption efforts and to offer recommendations for greater solutions as the government of Ukraine advances its reform efforts. But, as Vice President Biden said recently before the Ukrainian Rada, not enough has been done yet. He called for more reforms in the Office of the General Prosecutor, the judiciary, and energy sector. He pressed for more transparency in official sources of income and accountability of oligarchs. This is why the vice president announced almost $190 million in new American assistance to help Ukraine fight corruption, strengthen rule of law, implement reforms, bolster civil society, and advance energy security.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.